From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Israeli filmmaker and writer Etgar Kered is a cultural force in his own country and a challenge and delight to minds all over. Salman Rushdie calls him brilliant and completely unlike any writer he knows. People magazine says he can do more with six strange and funny paragraphs than most writers can in 600 pages. He's a fabulist who slips into and past everyday reality. He's been compared to Kafka, Vonnegut, Woody Allen. This hour on Point, Etgar Kered is with us. You can join the conversation. Do you read him? Do we need a fabulist these days to get at the reality of what's going on? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Etgar Kered joins me now from San Francisco. He's in the U.S. rolling out the English edition of his new collection of short stories, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. He's the son of Holocaust survivors, born in Tel Aviv, author of bestsellers like Four Stories, The Girl on the Fridge, and The Nimrod Flipout. Director of the award-winning film Jellyfish, his new collection of short fiction is translated from Hebrew to English by Miriam Schlesinger, Sandra Silverston, and Nathan Englander. The book is also out with an audiobook version, which we will hear from, with readings from voices like William Defoe, Dave Edgars, Miranda July, Ira Glass, and more. Etgar Kered in San Francisco, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back to On Point.
Hi, I'm happy to be on your show again. I'm just sad that my mother didn't hear your introduction.
Yes, I'm sorry. Maybe you can, maybe sometime, maybe somewhere.
Yeah, so she'll know I'm good for something.
Yeah. What's it like talking about your stories in English 2 years after they came out in Hebrew, and presumably many more years than that after you wrote some of them?
Well, I think that, you know, that a story is a state of mind. So when you read a story or hear a story or discuss a story from the past, it's a little bit like looking at a photo album and seeing a photo of yourself, you know, a few years ago. And then you say, wow, you know, I've gained weight since then, you know.
We last talked after, I think, Girl on the Fridge, which I just loved. And it was the first time that we had a chance to chat. And I have to say, I love that. I love this new collection as well. This fabulous way that you have. Did you always write this way? Did you always sort of take off from something that seems real and then end up in some place that seems wild?
Yeah, it's not a conscious decision. You know, there's something about the writing process that I think generally in life I'm kind of a control freak, but writing is all about losing control. I was saying the other day that it feels very much like those trust falls, you know, that couples have, you know, when
trust
they go
fall.
To counseling.
Just lean back and let yourself go into the crowd.
So it's like writing a story, it's like this kind of trust fall when you fall back and you kind of hope that a story will catch you, you know. But whatever is going to happen is just as much a surprise for me as it is for the reader.
I love to give our listeners a sense of your work, and maybe we could go right to the first story, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. It's the title of the entire collection as well. And you, right off, you have a writer here, a writer with your name, in quite an absurd situation. Do you want to read for us from the top? And then we'll hear, I think, Ira Glass recorded this story. But could you read a bit for us? Edgar?
Yeah, he'll read it much better, but I just read the beginning. Suddenly, a knock on the door. Tell me a story, the bearded man sitting on my living room sofa commands. The situation, I must say, is anything but pleasant. I'm someone who writes stories, not someone who tells them. And even that isn't something I do on demand. The last time anyone asked me to tell him a story, it was my son. That was a year ago. I told him something about a fairy and a ferret. I don't even remember what exactly. And within 2 minutes, he was fast asleep. But the situation is fundamentally different, because my son doesn't have a beard or a pistol. Because my son asked for the story nicely, and this man is simply trying to rob me of it.
Etgar Kered, reading from the very top of the first story in his new collection. And it's important to note there that the bearded man who's commanding him to tell a story has a pistol. Now, there's a lot of very prominent people reading for the audio version of this book. But let's go right on with that story, if we may, with a little more. And this story is read by host of Public Radio International's This American Life, Ira Glass. Here's this armed, bearded man demanding that the writer, Edgar Caret, tell him a story. Ira Glass takes it on.
I try to explain to the bearded man that if he puts his pistol away, it will only work in his favor, in our favor. It's hard to think of a story with the barrel of a loaded pistol pointed at your head. But the guy insists. In this country, he explains, if you want something, you have to use force. He just got here from Sweden, and in Sweden it's completely different. Over there, if you want something, you ask politely, and most of the time you get it. But not in the stifling, muggy Middle East. All it takes is 1 week in this place to figure out how things work, or rather, how things don't work. The Palestinians asked for a state, nicely. Did they get one? The hell they did. So they switched to blowing up kids on buses, and people started listening. The settlers wanted a dialogue. Did anybody pick up on it? No way. So they started getting physical, pouring hot oil on the border patrolmen. Suddenly, they had an audience. And this country might makes right. And it doesn't matter if it's about politics or economics or parking space. Brute force is the only language we understand.
Ira Glass reading there from Edgar Caret's title story from his collection, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. Now, it's funny, Edgar, we're talking about fabulism, but if you just hear what Ira just read, it sounds more like a political tract, like a political essay, than what it goes on to be. A pollster arrives at the door. He's also got a pistol and demands a story. A pizza guy arrives. He doesn't have a pistol, but he's got a knife. You start, the character in the story starts to describe what's going on as a story, and they say, hey, that's not a story. That's an eyewitness report. This one comes pretty close to some direct political commentary before you veer off, Edgar.
I think it's more kind of a social commentary, and you know, it's placed in Israel, but I think it's relevant for the entire world or the human race. I think that for me at least, telling a story or listening to a story is a mechanism that help us survive. Because sometimes when you live through a reality that it's so arbitrary and so violent and you cannot inexplicable, the only way to make sense of it is to take a bunch of those things and kind of connect them by some plot that will kind of make sense out of this world around you. It may be more extreme in Israel than in other places, but I think that that this need kind of to make sense out of things. And to do it through telling a story is universal.
We at one point in this story, your character, the character of your own name, says, "Hey, what's up? You know, Amos Oz doesn't get in this kind of situation. David Grossman, famous Israeli writers, your elders don't get in this kind of situation. What's it like for an active, fabulous imagination like yours to work in that? I mean, your character here says, you know, the only thing that works in this country, this culture, is brute force. What's it like to be a writer in that kind of environment? It's not as if the rest of the world is exactly a paradise of peace, but you got a special tang to it in Israel, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that the reason I mentioned humorously is that, you know, that I don't think that anybody comes and asks Amos Oz or David Grossman at gunpoint to tell them a story. I think it says something about the kind of dialogue that they have with the readers and I have with mine, because I think that I write most of my stories from a position of weakness. You know, you can tell a story as somebody who gives his readers an advice and you're a smarter and wiser person. Or you can write a story as somebody who talks to his neighbor or the guys that sit next to him in the bus and say, yeah, man, you know, my life is ruined, maybe you can help me. And I'm the second kind, so this kind is more prone to have people kind of aiming pistols at him and demanding stuff from him. And for me, I chose art because of some feeling of weakness. I think, you know, let's say if I could change life, if I could turn life into something that would be perfect and make sense, I wouldn't sit in a room and make up stories that never happened. You know, it was the plan B, you know, when you bump into a wall and you can't break that wall, then you write a story about transcending that wall.
So it's not the heroic writer here exactly, though there's some heroic leaps of imagination and insight, I'd say. But writing from that position of weakness I think that's why people turn around and make these comparisons between you and Kafka or Woody Allen, who famously makes his art from a sort of position of narrator weakness.
Well, I must say that, you know, that Kafka was the greatest influence on me, and what was so great in his influence, you know, I read Kafka during basic training, which is something that I recommend doing.
Military basic training, yeah, okay.
Yeah, compulsory perfect. Military basic yeah. training. Yeah. And the idea is that when I went through it, I felt like, you know, that I was the most kind of stressed, scared, incompetent person in the world. And then I read Kafka and I discovered that I was the second most stressed and incompetent person in the world. He was the first. And I think that there is something about kind of sharing your fears and anxieties when you write, it kind of legitimizes them, because in the end, when people read it, they say to you, you know what, I also don't understand what's going on, but I've been hiding it. But now that you put it on the table, okay, I'm admitting it too. You know, there is something about this experience, this kind of thing called life, that, you know, I went through the manual, but I really didn't figure out how it works yet. You know, people do stuff that I just can't explain, and I pretend as if it's okay. But now that I read your story, I can say to you, you know what? I'm scared too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour with Israeli writer, hipster, fabulist Etgar Keret. His latest collection of probing, fantastical short fiction is Suddenly a Knock on the Door, out a couple of years ago in Hebrew, now out in this country in English. And it's a pretty great read. He joins us today from San Francisco, filmmaker, Tel Aviv-born, and quite a figure in his own right. There's an audio version of the book out as well, with readings from a really interesting lineup of people: William Defoe, Miranda July, Dave Eggers, Ira Glass, we just heard, and more. Edgar, I want to hear Miranda July reading from your story, Unzipping. Before we do, is there anything else, anything you want to tell us about this story?
No, I just want to say that when I've emailed it to Miranda and I asked her if she'll be willing to read the story, and she said yes. And after she read it, I said, you read it so wonderful. And she said, when I was in the studio, I thought it was my story. And I hope I'm going to write another one like this soon.
good. So here it is, a bit of Unzipping, read in this clip here by the indie filmmaker Miranda July. It's a tale of doubt, questioning your closest partner and identity, even your own, when a woman named Ella discovers something unusual under her partner Siki's tongue, a zipper.
It began with a kiss. It almost always begins with a kiss. Ella and Siki were in bed, naked, with only their tongues touching, when she felt something prick her. "Did I hurt you?" Siki asked, and when she shook her head, he quickly added, "You're bleeding." And she was, from the mouth. "I'm sorry," he said, and he started a frantic search in the kitchen, pulling ice cube trays out of the freezer and banging them against the counter. "Here, take these," he said, handing her some ice with a shivering hand. "Put them against your lip, it'll stop the bleeding." Siki had always been good at those things. In the army, he'd been a paramedic. He was a trained tour guide, too. "I'm sorry," he went on, turning paler. "I must have bitten you, you know, in the heat of passion." "Never mind," she smiled at him, the ice cube sticking to her lower lip. "Nothing happened." Which was a lie, of course, because something had happened. It isn't every day that someone you're living with makes you bleed and then lies to you and says he bit you when you distinctly felt something pricking you. They didn't kiss for a few days after that because of her cut. Lips are a very sensitive part of the body. And later, when they could, they had to be very careful. She could tell he was hiding something. And sure enough, one night, taking advantage of the fact that he slept with his mouth open, she gently slipped her finger under his tongue and found it. It was a zipper. A teensy zipper. But when she pulled at it, her whole Siki opened up like an oyster, and inside was Jürgen. Unlike Siki, Jürgen had a goatee, meticulously shaped sideburns, and an uncircumcised penis. Ella watched him in his sleep. Very, very quietly, she folded up the Siki wrapping and hid it in the kitchen cabinet behind the trash can, where they kept the garbage bags.
And they're only the beginning in Edgar Keret's short fiction, Unzipping, from his collection, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. Read there by the indie filmmaker Miranda July. Zipper under the tongue, she can't resist it. And ooh, there's Jürgen, not Tsiki.
You know, the amazing thing about this audiobook project is that, let's say, after listening to Miranda reading it, I like the story better and I kind of understand it in a different kind of way because there is a synergy there. You know, when somebody comes and reads, he doesn't read it, he gives his interpretation. And frankly, the way that she read the story is so much more interesting than the way I wrote it.
That's the Heisenberg principle at work. Is that because it's in English or because of her attitude, because of an American attitude? What are you hearing there?
No, it's because of her attitude. I mean, you know, I think she's a genius, and I think that her ability to kind of project some sort of vulnerability that exists in the story, but she's able to kind of push it to the forefront, you know, it's really amazing. And I'm so happy to hear uncircumcised penis on NPR. You know, I didn't even know that you were allowed to say uncircumcised penis on public radio.
It's a part of life. It's a part of life, is it not? And not unimportant to this story. I mean, after all, I'm kind of assuming you're suggesting that Ella and Tsiki are Israeli and Jewish lovers, and she pulls this zipper. Tsiki opens like an oyster, and inside is Jürgen, which sounds like a German, Edgar.
Yeah, he's a goy. He's a goy. Try to bring a goy, you know, to your family for a Friday dinner. You know, it's not that easy.
So what's it mean that her Israeli lover is a goy, a Gentile, a German inside?
Well, I'm not sure I can explain the story. You know, I think the story kind of came from a dream. But I think it's all about the fact that our life always kind of carries some sort of a potential. And we have kind of different things in us that we never set free. So so we could actually live a different life with a different partner. We ourselves could find a zipper under our tongue and find out that we are different people and live a different life as those different people. So I think it's kind of a metaphor about that, about this gap between the life we're living, the life we can live. You know, would it be better? Would it be worse?
And, of course, as we go on, Ella herself finds a little zipper under her own tongue. And then the question, does one pull that zipper? Edgar Keret is with us. His new collection is Suddenly a Knock on the Door. Joins us today from San Francisco. And we've got callers for you, Edgar. William in Amherst, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Edgar Keret.
Hey, Tom. I just have a question for the author. Pretty much, you know, if you're starting with the surreal and you also have these political or human condition commentary that goes within your stories, how do you gauge what stays and what goes in the rewriting process? How much do you give the audience enough that they get to know the characters while maintaining your message about, you know, what you're trying to say?
Some of these are so short there's not a room for a lot to stay, but what about it, Edgar?
Well, actually, when I write the first drafts, they're always longer. But I feel like, you know, I feel like, let's say, when I tell a story, when I write a story, it's like trying to get to some place in a boat that has a hole in the bottom. And my editing process is basically hysterically throwing stuff overboard. Many of my 3-page stories were written as 9 or 12-page stories, and I just cut them short because I say, you know, I want to get there. There's something about the stories that they're all about some sort of kind of a passion that it's difficult to articulate. And when I write a story, I see that I wrote something that may be beautiful or perfect, but it's not getting me to the place that I want. So I just throw it overboard, you know.
William, can you hear that?
Yeah, I heard. Yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate your call. And let's get one more for Edgar Keret from Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael's calling. Hi, Michael. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I want to say not familiar with a lot of fiction, but I really love the movie Jellyfish. I have a question. Edgar is called an Israeli writer, and I find it interesting that certainly in the movie there was almost nothing that spoke to Israel the way we mostly hear and deal with Israel. And I'm just wondering what he would have to say about the fact that as a fabulist, it seems like he's totally detached from the realities of that beset Israel. Maybe that's a luxury that finally is available, or just wonder about his reactions to that.
Are you challenging his artistic right to be a fabulist, or just the tension with the surrounding political realities? What there, Michael, just so we know.
I'd like him to respond to that tension, yes.
Mm-hmm. Edgar?
Yeah, what I feel many times is, let's say, when you live in a place that is so political that when you try to talk about the issues themselves using, let's say, the political setting, you tend to kind of fall into cliches or just repeat things that people had said or disagree with them. And I think that there is something about the fabulist angle that can kind of helps you bypass the setting and reach the undercurrent under them. You know, because let's say you could talk about if Israel should go to the 67 border or should go to the 48 one, mm-hmm. but when I write a story, it's stories about fear of the other, fear of oneself, the wish to transcend, you know, and all those kind of things. They are the materials that make politics. I really don't like it when people see politics something that is kind of extraterritorial to life. You know, I think politics are made of emotions, and when you touch those emotions in a certain way, you basically the shadow of what you're saying is very political.
Nancy Updike writes about you and wrote about you in the New York Times Magazine, and she says you're not just widely read in Israel, but absorbed, and above all by the young. Is there a generational gap or difference in the way you're received by Israeli readers? I mean, you're a different generation from Amos Oz, David Grossman. Is it the young who've most embraced your kind of symbolic or fabulist way of dealing with this reality, life?
I think that many of my readers are from the younger generation, and I think that one of the reasons for that is that historically, Israel fiction, which is amazing fiction, we have wonderful writers, it kind of tells the story of the group, the story of the country. Mm-hmm. It deals with those political issues that the last caller referred to in a direct way. And I think that my stories many times deal with the outsider who kind of sees this group narrative and can't find himself in it. And I think that many young people identify with this situation. You know, it's kind of like the stories are some sphere, some kind of AA meeting for people who say, we're part of this country, we love this country, but sometimes we see stuff about ourselves in TV, we read stuff about ourselves in paper, people talk in us instead of just I, and we don't find our place in that group, you know. And I think that those young people, they feel close to my protagonists.
Steve Almond, a writer who I really admire, wrote about this collection in the New York Times. It was funny. He said, if you lived in Brooklyn, you would have been hogtied already by a pack of rabid literary agents in order to drop the shtick, I guess, of your fabulous short stories and write a novel already. But he goes on to say that you evince Bruno Bettelheim, the psychoanalyst, and what Bettelheim called the uses of enchantment in Almond writing, the ability to compel readers to experience the hidden terror, their hidden terrors by means of symbolic narrative. Is that explicit in your mind, what you're up to when writing, maybe for an Israeli or for that matter, any audience?
You know, when I read this incredible review, it rang true, but it's not intentional. I think in many ways, kind of writing my stories is like telling somebody a dream that I had. And later, you know, I can sit with somebody and analyze that dream, but the dream came from a place that is completely unconscious. And I think that this is what Steve Almond refers to, the fact that it's not a story that were made in some sort, in a premeditated kind of story lab. Mm-hmm. It's something that just kind of jumped out of the unconscious and kind of found its way to a book.
Let's take a call from Manchester, Connecticut, and Jerry. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you very much. It's a fascinating show. I'm curious. I grew up with the Twilight Zone and Rob Serling's writings, and it sounds, as I'm listening to these short stories, it sounds like a series of Twilight Zones all strung together. And I'm just curious if that was an influence at all in your a writer's background.
Somehow, to my eye anyway, a slightly less ominous than The Twilight Zone. But what about it, Edgar? Do you even know The Twilight Zone growing up in
television? Oh, yeah, yeah. I know The Twilight Zone. I think there's something in my stories that they are like, there could be like kind of a cross between a Twilight Zone episode and something else. But I don't know. It's The Twilight Zone and your wife crying while she argues with you. You know, it's like it's both kind of like something that is very strange, but at the same time something that is very emotional and intimate. I don't think that my stories are kind of idea driven like many of the Twilight Zone episodes. I think that they are emotionally driven, and that emotion kind of manufactures some kind of an idea. So I think that it has a Twilight Zone aspect, but I don't think that it has the same engine that the Twilight Zone episode did.
Jerry, thanks so much for your call. Let's hear a little more. This is from Creative Writing, a story. It's read here by the actor Stanley Tucci. Edgar Caret tells the tale of the writer and the tale of a woman named Maya. His husband, Aviad, convinces her to take a creative writing class to help her move on from the tragedy reality of a miscarriage.
Her third story started out funny. It was about a pregnant woman who gave birth to a cat. The hero of the story was the husband, who suspected that the cat wasn't his. A fat ginger tomcat that slept on the lid of the dumpster right below the window of the couple's bedroom gave the husband a condescending look every time he went downstairs to throw out the garbage. In the end, there was a violent clash between the husband and the cat. The husband threw a stone at the cat, who countered with bites and scratches. The injured husband, his wife, and the kitten she was breastfeeding went to the clinic for him to get a rabies shot. He was humiliated and in pain, but tried not to cry while they were waiting. The kitten, sensing his suffering, curled itself from its mother's embrace, went over to him, and licked his face tenderly, offering a consoling meow. "Did you hear that?" the mother asked emotionally. He said, "Daddy." At that point, the husband could no longer hold back his tears. And when Aviad read that passage, he had to try hard not to cry too. Maya said that she'd started writing the story even before she knew she was pregnant again. "Isn't it weird," she asked, "how my brain didn't know yet, but my subconscious did?"
My brain didn't know yet, but my subconscious did, from Edgar Caret's Creative Writing. Newsweek says that you give us a glimpse into the Israeli subconscious. Do you think it's got a national tilt to it, Edgar? Is it universal? Is it Israeli?
I think that it's Israeli in its core, but I think that, you know, that living in Israel isn't that different than living any other place. It's the same life, but on a louder volume, you know? It's just everything that you know from your life, but more extreme. You know, there's more stress and more violence and more fear, but it's more of something that you already know.
And right in the middle of that, your sense of humor, or Maya's, you put it in her as she writes her pregnant woman who gives birth to a cat, and the hero of the story was the husband who suspected that the cat wasn't his. Edgar Caret, it is great to have you. Please stand by there in San Francisco. We've got much more to hear, and it's great to have all these terrific voices reading from the work as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with Israeli writer, hipster, fabulist Edgar Caret. His latest collection of probing fantastical short fiction is Suddenly a Knock on the Door, with an audio version as well, read by all kinds of interesting people: Ira Glass, Willem Dafoe, Dave Eggers, Miranda July, and more. Edgar Caret is in the U.S. right now for the English language translation rollout of his originally Hebrew collection, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. Joins us today from San Francisco. Edgar, questions from some of our listeners online. Well, a comment first from Leora, who writes on our website, says, "Great writer," and asks, "Do you know his first name, Edgar, means challenge in Hebrew? I wonder what your parents intended exactly by that." And it may be related to another. Julia writes and asks, she says, "Please ask if being the child of Holocaust survivors contributed to his style or subject matter." She says, "Being a second generationer myself," I guess also the child of Holocaust survivors, she says, "I imagine it would." What about those two, Edgar?
Well, first of all, my name is like challenge. Edgar means challenge. And Keret means big city. So basically the name my parents gave me was Urban Challenge, which is a very good name for a pair of sneakers, but pretty strange name for a child.
What did it mean? Build great cities, Israel, or something else?
No, basically big city was just the family name, which was, because we were called Kototsovsky, and they looked for something shorter that would have a meaning in Hebrew. And my mother called me Challenge because I was born after a few miscarriages. When she was at the beginning of her 6 months of pregnancy, I got tied in my own umbilical cord.
Yes.
And because I had an older brother and sister, the doctors recommended an abortion.
Oh.
But she refused. And when I was born, you know, I weighed 900 grams.
Wow.
The doctors said, I will die. And she called me Challenge because it was a challenge to have me.
Sounds like it. We're glad you made it through all that, and good for her for hanging in there.
Yeah, no, but the truth is that, you know, it is a strange name for a child, and you know, going back to compulsory army service and basic training, then, you know, when you're called Challenge and you have a sergeant who think he has some sense of humor, he will always say, Challenge, you have a challenge, go clean the restrooms, you know?
Mm.
And I heard that joke so many times, and cleaned so many restrooms that I wished, you know, my name was
anything else.
Sanhel,
take it easy,
or Tom, or
right,
whatever.
Right. On the not funny side of that, I mean, the story is that you began writing short stories during that compulsory military duty when your best friend committed suicide at the base where you were both serving. Was writing part of your way of responding to that terrible circumstance?
For sure. I wrote my first story 2 weeks after I found my friend, you know, after he shot himself. And I think that when somebody very close to you commits suicide, then I think that the instinct is always to ask yourself, why did he do it, and find something definite that is not relevant for you to say, okay, I don't know, his girlfriend left him, or he was crazy, or, you know. And if you say, okay, if my girlfriend didn't leave me and I'm not crazy, then I am fine. But with my friend, you know, he was very close to me, and when he killed himself, you know, this kind of question of, why don't I kill myself, kind of popped into my head. And I guess writing was kind of my way of answering that question. You know, I think that in a very, very strange and weird way, my stories are kind of recommendations about life, you know. Yeah. It's like, I think that kind of encountering suicide gave me this feeling for the first time that the fact that I'm living is a choice, that I choose to live, and that if I choose to live, I should respect that choice, and I should live a life worth living. You know, before that, I had this kind of born never asked attitude, saying, you know, it's crap, but what can I do? Mm-hmm. You know, I never asked for it.
Edgar Caret, there's plenty that's Israeli in this collection, right from the title story, which we heard some. There is plenty that is universal, very universal, and there's some that's actually kind of aimed at the United States. There's a one story called Pick a Color. And if we might, I'd like to listen to a little bit of that here. It's read by actor Robert Wisdom in the audio version. And it is Edgar Caret's portrait of American race relations with a kind of artist's eye on, you know, philosopher's eye, maybe, on color.
A black man moved into a white neighborhood. He had a black house with a black porch where he used to sit every morning and drink his black coffee. Until one black night, his white neighbors came into his house and beat him. He lay there, curled up like an umbrella handle in a pool of black blood, and they kept on beating him until one of them started yelling that they should stop, because if he died on them, they might end up in prison. The black man didn't die on them. An ambulance came and took him far, far away to an enchanted hospital on the top of an inactive volcano. The hospital was white. Its gates were white. The walls of its rooms were white, and so was the bedding. The black man began to recover and fall in love with a white nurse in a white uniform who took care of him with great devotion and kindness. She loved him too. And like him, That love of theirs grew stronger with every passing day, grew stronger and learned to get out of bed and crawl like a small child, like a baby, like a black man who had been badly beaten. They got married in a yellow church. A yellow priest married them. His yellow parents had come to that country on a yellow ship. They had been beaten up by their white neighbors, too. But he didn't get into all that with the black man. He barely knew him. And anyway, he didn't want to go there, what with the ceremony and everything. He planned to say that God loves them and wishes them all the best. The yellow man didn't know that for sure. He tried lots of times to convince himself that he did, that he knows that God loves everyone and wishes us all only the best. But that day, when he married that battered black man, not even 30, and already covered with scars and sitting in a wheelchair, it was harder for him to believe. God loves you both, he finally said anyway. God loves you and wishes you all the best, he said, and was ashamed.
Actor Robert Wisdom reading from Edgar Corret's Pick a Color. Of course, in this story, they go on to meet God, and God himself is in a wheelchair and things have been difficult and says, yes, things are difficult. That's just a reflection of my experience, more or less. Edgar Corret joins us from San Francisco. Edgar, what are you telling us here about color and skin color and culture in America? Are we color obsessed? Is that the idea?
Well, you know, many of my stories are like fable. And when I wrote this story, I kind of placed it in the U.S. because I wanted to go to a place that is distant from where I live. But it is very much about Israel, and it's very much about xenophobia and fear from everything that is different from you. You know, the fact that the only thing that you say about a person is his color already kind of puts it in a very central place. And you know, and in the story, really, God comes in a wheelchair, and God kind of, when he explains why we act the way we act, why we are afraid of the other, then he kind of says, you know, I created you in my image, and this is me. You know, if I would have been a perfect God, you would be perfect people, but I also hurt, I also have my pains. And, you know, I come from a very fragmented society. There are tensions between Israelis, Jews and Arabs, Sephardic Israelis and Ashkenazic one, mm-hmm. Russian immigrants and Jewish ultra-Orthodox. So all this idea of kind of seeing somebody and saying, he's different, so I hate him, I'll be aggressive to him, I wouldn't want to connect to him. I think there was something about it that kind of started this story.
I have
to figure out why.
Yeah, I have to say, as an American reader, it certainly vibrated quite universally with me, though I get the context that you're giving us right there. Lots of callers for you. Elia is calling from Boston. Elia, you're on the air with Edgar Corret.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, I have to say that I'm a huge fan of Edgar Corret. So that's that.
Yes.
And what I'm calling about is that it saddens me somewhat to hear readers and reviewers focus so much on what Edgar may be saying about politics or struggle merely because he's an Israeli writer, when in actuality, unless I'm wrong, he may not actually be writing about those things, but more so about things that relate to the human experience, regardless of who you are or where you live in the world. And that said, what I'm interested in is whether Edgar can share with us, as a creative person, regardless of the fact that he's Israeli, what is your writing process like, and where do these amazing stories come from? Are they stories that come from a scenario that you imagine and then you write, or do you actually think of some kind of message you want to deliver, and then you formulate a scenario around that and deliver it that way?
Thank you, Elliot. We'll go to exactly those. Edgar, let's go to process first. The other is an interesting big question, but what about process?
When I write a story, it's usually about kind of something that happened to me and moved me, but that I can't share with other people. You know, I can see something in the street or hear a sentence, and when I go back to my wife and I try to tell her about it, she says, that's completely boring what you're saying. And kind of, and then I kind of sit down and kind of writing it is trying to sort out what was in that thing that had moved me. So it's kind of like a quest. Many times when something extraordinary happens to me and I go back to my wife and I tell her about it and she says to me, wow, that's amazing, or that's sad, I know that there's no story in it. So I just let go. But when you have this kind of gap between what you feel and what you're able to communicate, then then you know that you may have a story going.
And Itkar, what about our caller's wish that we see you, in her word, regardless of your Israeli identity? There is clearly abundant, universal material in your work. But what about your Israeli identity at the same time? She wants us to set that aside and look at you more universally. I think we have, and I'm happy to do it. But how do you see it?
I totally identify with her, but I think that there's something that is a little bit complicated than that. Let's say if I would have been an Eskimo writer, then and people would interview me in the States and say, why don't you write more about the cold? You know, how cold it is, you know. And the thing is that I don't write about the fact that, you know, it's very cold and it's to live inside an igloo, but I think that it's always there. So I do write about the human condition, and I am interested in the human condition, but I do believe that if I would have lived in another place, then my stories would have been fundamentally different, and that if you that they talk about a universal situation, about universal emotions, but my starting point came from a very specific environment.
Stephen Marsh wrote in the foreword, he says, Carrot may be the most important writer working in Israel right now. Certainly he's the closest observer of the post-Intifada, post-Oslo spiritual condition. Are you the great interpreter of the contemporary Israeli spiritual condition?
Well, if I am, then we are in a very tough spot, you know, because I'm really, like, because, you know, I think that many times when you speak to Israeli commentators and politicians, they always kind of gave you this feeling that they understand the situation, they understand how the Palestinians think, they understand what motivates the Iranians. With me, when I talk about some state of mind, I always kind of look at the picture and I say to myself, what's wrong with the picture? You know, I can be critical of things, but I must say that that I'm afraid that I don't always know what the other thinks. I'm not always sure that I have the right answers. But the thing that I look for is some sort of a yearning or some sort of a optimism among Israeli politicians. I don't want to talk to people who have all the answers. I want to talk to people who think that we should try harder and believe that things can get better.
And what about much earlier, Julia asked us, and I think we never got back to it, how the fact of being a Holocaust survivor's child factors into your work. She asks it earnestly, and I don't want to leave that hanging.
No, I think that my parents and my family in general were the greatest influence on my writing. I think that, you know, my parents were both Holocaust survivors who had a very strong optimism in them. They somehow, I don't know how, they believed in mankind. They believed that things can get better. They fought, you know, they saw all that darkness, but they said, you know what? It could be different. And I think that the fact that they went through a different kind of reality, and whenever I would go with them to the street, you know, my mother would say to me, you know, if you eat at the table and the guy next to you uses his fork to eat from his plate and not yours, and he doesn't try to stab you with it, just be thankful. It's a good day. You know, appreciate that. And there is something about that, this kind of thing, that things could go differently. It's many times the engine of many of my stories. You know, you have a normal situation and then things go differently. And this is what my parents always spoke about.
I read that after this output in Suddenly a Knock on the Door, you haven't really written much more short fiction since then. So what are you doing?
I spent most of my time taking care of my father, who became very ill. He died a few weeks ago.
I'm sorry.
And the truth is that throughout all this period, I really didn't have any urge to write. You know, it was just more about talking and listening to my father, who was an amazing person. And I kind of, you know, I'm just glad that I had the time to spend. I had the chance to spend so much time with him in his last months of living.
And when the time comes, do you expect it will go to print on paper or film?
I really don't know yet. I kind of I'm scribbling all kinds of things, and some of them could turn into movies, and some of them could turn into, I don't know, operas, and some of them could turn into books, but I really don't know what I'm going to do next.
Edgar Caret, you've got a really special intelligence and creativity and heart, and I so enjoy having it right here with us. It's very kind of you to take the time. We appreciate your coming on. Congratulations on the new edition coming out in the U.S.
Well, thank you very much. I so much like talking to you. You know, maybe once we could do it without, you know, the audience. can meet for a coffee or something.
That would be terrific. Edgar Caret joins us from San Francisco. His new collection of short fiction is Suddenly a Knock on the Door. You can get a nice excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website as well, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.